Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 16th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton, writer for Salon.com. Proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo. Also on the program today, David Feldman of the David Feldman Show. Meanwhile, released video shows Chicago police shot and killed a 13-year-old boy with his hands raised. Meanwhile, shooter in Indianapolis FedEx warehouse kills eight, including himself. Worldwide COVID infections surge as stateside hospitalizations climb. Biden said to be hesitant of optics, and that's why he's keeping the refugees admitted into this country at a number lower than the Trump administration. Republicans laid bare they can't figure out how to counteroffer on the jobs and infrastructure bill. AOC splits with the New York congressional delegation over state and local tax deductions to end up saving the wealthiest Americans, the vast majority of money. Meanwhile, Vanita Gupta on track to be confirmed to be the Associate Attorney General. U.S. sanctions Russia over its cyber hacking. Meanwhile, the Biden administration says evidence thin on that Russian Taliban bounty story. Biden's DOJ still seizing land for the border wall. Where the administration is also lifting a ban on fetal tissue research. And lastly, the DOD says UFOs are real. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Emma Vigeland is out for the day. I will be here with just Matt and Brendan on the line. And, of course, our guest. I exaggerate a little bit about the DOD saying that the UFOs are real. They did confirm that leaked photos and videos of the unidentified aerial phenomenon taken in 2019 are indeed legitimate images of unexplained objects.
Which is not to say aliens.
Exactly. They're just simply aerial objects that they will not identify or cannot identify. I suspect they have an idea of what it is, but they're not going to tell us. And that does not mean it's necessarily aliens.
ET.
Yeah, I would say not. I do like the fact that they don't say unidentified flying objects, because that would give everybody, that would legitimize things too much. So they call it unidentified aerial phenomena. So,
well, also it might not be flying. It might be hovering or something like that. So
good point. That's a UAP instead of a UFO.
Doesn't sound as scary.
No, it doesn't. Let's talk about the Adam Toledo video that dropped in Chicago. It is, we won't play the video. it's not hard to find it. You can find it on the Chicago Tribune website. There are actually two different angles on the Chicago Tribune website. A police officer chasing after a 13-year-old boy in an alley. Apparently, they were called to the scene by artificial intelligence that had signaled there had been a gunshot fired somewhere. The boy is running down an alley. There is a wooden fence to the boy's right. And the police officer is yelling at him to stop. The boy stops at a gap in the fence. There is video from a security camera pretty far away that may or may not show him making a tossing motion with something behind the fence. The police officer essentially stops and yells at him to turn around, you know, to raise his hands. He raises his hands, and within a second, he is shot by the police officer dead. And the police officers purportedly found a gun against that wooden fence. It's unclear from the clips I've seen whether the body camera is continuous throughout that. There, in other words, there's no cuts, because of course, you know, it's not. It certainly happened in the past that police officers have placed guns and other things in certain areas, but presumably somebody has seen the body camera, and there's been no reports that the body camera was turned off at any point. This is, of course, you know, on top of all the other the Dante Wright killing, which is, you know, I mean, just and the Floyd killing trial. Derek Chauvin, all happening this week. Here is Lori Lightfoot saying that Chicago failed Adam Toledo, 13-year-old boy. Here she is.
And simply put, we failed Adam. And we cannot afford to fail one more young person in our city. We must do everything we can also to eliminate the scourge of firearms from our city. Every year, the Chicago Police Department recovers more guns than New York and LA combined. Not because we have a better strategy, not because we pay more attention, but because we have too many damn guns on our streets.
It should be said, she also said that earlier, if I'm not mistaken, that he had a gun in his hand when he was shot.
Yes.
And that was the prosecutor overturned by the video.
Apparently also said that, that he had a gun in his hand when he was shot. And the video clearly shows both his hands up in the air before he is shot. Here is a former Chicago police superintendent saying that this was a good shooting.
Gary, what do you see?
Well, listen, first of all, I got to say that while Dan was chasing people in the 7-5, I was doing the same thing in the 4-6 precinct in the Bronx. And while I have enormous respect for Alderman Lopez, I have to disagree, because you know what? I know what's in that officer's mind because I've done it before. I've chased God knows how many people with guns. I did it as the superintendent here. And by the way, Sean, you got me very depressed listening to what's going on in Chicago, because the fact is, you know, I ran New York's crime strategy for 7 years, 2 years under Mayor Giuliani, 5 years under Mayor Bloomberg. We know how to do this. And when I was the superintendent here, we had 50-year lows in the murder rate. It's gone up 100% since that termination back in 2015. The bottom line is, we know how to do this in policing. We're not doing it. And we're not doing it for a number of reasons. The single most important factor is the politics of this country today. What I'm seeing is tons of newspaper people, news folks, trying to make what is apparently a good shooting bad. I know what was going through that officer's head.
Let me,
because I had so many times.
Let me give a quick last word, if I can, Alderman.
So it's the press that's trying to make this into a bad shooting as opposed to a good shooting. The idea that this guy who is in charge of policing would, and I know he's being colloquial here on some level, but the idea that he would perceive this as a good shooting, a legit shooting, you know, if that's the case, why isn't the police officer just firing as the kid is running? I mean, what more can the kid do? The police officer says, stop, raise your hands. And
the function of that is just to make him a stationary target.
I mean, apparently. Right. Like, what's the point? If you're going to fire as soon as he complies, why would you have fired before then? Why are you chasing him so closely? Like you know, and ultimately, the problem is that they're going out and they are looking for trouble in some respects, and people who don't necessarily present a danger to our society are paying the price.
I mean, that shot spotter element. So you basically have cops who largely come from the suburban white communities around these areas going into communities based off of a computer signal with no other context for that and with guns. This is what happened.
I want to play this clip. This was I found this on Twitter. It's actually a series of three clips. This is from February 2020. So it's, you know, from a while ago. It doesn't this guy, I guess the guy's name is Ace Perry. And he's in Sampson County, North Carolina. There are three series of videos. He gets pulled over and he sets up, I guess he's got two phones. One might be a work phone, one might be his personal. And he puts the phone in the well of the car because he doesn't know why he's being stopped by this sheriff. We just picked the video from the in between, but it is, it's not in any way violent. It's not in any way violent in terms of there's nothing being shot, but there's an undertone of a threat here. And this driver can't figure out, well, I mean, he knows why he's been pulled over, but he can't get the cop to say why. Watch this.
Absolutely no sign of.
Hey, morning. How are you, sir? Deputy Snow with the Sampson County Sheriff's Office. You got your license and registration on you?
I do.
Okay.
All right, may I ask what the stop is for, sir?
I'll let you know as soon as you give me your ID. Who you work for there? Your shirt.
Dillmore Oil Company.
Dillmore Oil Company?
Yes, sir.
Okay. How long you been there?
May I ask why that is?
Well, I'm just talking, Jim. I see your shirt there. I'm just asking. Is it wrong to ask you questions about where you work?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what that has to do with the stop.
Okay. All right. Well, if you don't want, you know, just casual conversation, that's fine.
Since
I got you stopped here, you're driving 65.
Information gathered.
Wait, go back, because you got to hear. He just explains to him why he's being stopped. I mean, let me tell you, I want people to think about what could possibly be the reason why this guy is being stopped. Listen to this. It's stunning. I've never even heard of anybody getting stopped for this.
Is it wrong to ask you questions about where you work?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what that has to do with the stop.
Okay. All right. Well, if you don't want, you know, just casual conversation, that's fine.
Since I got you
stopped here, you're driving 65 and, you know, speed limit 7. I'm just wondering what's wrong. I mean, are you okay?
Other than...
I mean, you okay? I mean, you ain't...
Traveling 5 miles below the speed limit is
a reason.
Yes,
sir. I'm just checking on you. That's all I'm doing, okay?
Yes, sir.
You good?
I'm great.
Awesome.
How are you?
I'm doing better than I deserve, you know. You got the paperwork for the vehicle?
It's actually a rental car. The only paperwork that I have is via email.
It's what?
A rental car.
But what were you saying about something? You said something right after that.
The only paperwork they give you is via email.
Okay. You pull it up digitally?
I can.
Okay. How long you got it for?
Until I decide to take it back.
Oh, okay. They don't have like a scheduled day to return it?
They do, but unfortunately for my schedule right now, I'm not able to.
I think that's the end of that's the end of anyways this installment of it. A couple of things that are just amazing. The guy was pulled over because he was going 65 in a 70 mile an hour zone. Has anybody ever like listening to the word, you know, like, well, I imagine maybe this is not that there are black people maybe who have been pulled over, but I, you know, are there any white people who have ever been pulled over for going 5 miles under the speed limit when the speed limit's 70?
No, I remember just driving around Fargo, just basically because I had nothing to do listening to podcasts. I would regularly go like 15 and a 25 or stuff like that because you're just hanging out.
I was never bothered.
That was never in my, I never had to worry about cops.
But the idea of going 65 miles an hour on a 70 mile hour highway, right, and getting pulled, it's just absurd. It's just absurd. The better than I deserve, that's Dave Ramsey thing. So this is a cop. This is a cop who listens to a right wing radio. You can see the other things here. I mean, and the cop comes up at the end when he realizes he's being videotaped, and gives the guy, oh, also wants to know where he's coming from, where he's been driving for back and forth. And he comes up and he gives the driver a warning and says, I'm not going to ticket you today. I'm just going to give you a warning. And the guy looks at the thing and he's like, what am I getting the warning for? And he goes out and he asks the cop, but the cop sees that he's got a video camera. I mean, this is the context in which, and so the point is, you know, what is the relationship between that traffic stop, in quotes, and the shootings we see? Is just simply that there is an enormous amount of police in this country, and it's a function of our society, you know, writ large, that necessarily as soon as they see a black person, there is an elevated threat. And it either manifests itself in randomly pulling over a person on the highway, or pulling the trigger on your weapon just in the blink of an eye. And I don't know how you don't start dealing with that without wholesale changes in policing, like no traffic stops. And like very, very, very narrow situations where you're following anyone, you're running after anybody while holding a gun. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton, or you may know her, Digby. Be right back after this. Folks, just a reminder, this program is sponsored in part by SunsetLakesCBD.com. Sunset Lakes CBD 420 sale started a week ago, and it will run through the 23rd. So we're right in the middle of it. Folks, you can use the coupon code 420 and get 30% off their entire purchase. There has been a lot of controversy about this 420 thing. I got an email last night from somebody saying that was the longtime listener, Susan, claims that 420 was the police code, saying that they found, and that apparently, I mean, I did some fact checking on this, not the case. It is more back, you know, and there was a medical marijuana legalization bill in California named 420, but Matt, When you write, you write. I shouldn't have doubted you, particularly when it comes to this.
Right.
It turns out that supposedly it came from some high school kids in Oakland in the 70s who would gather at around 4:20 every day to smoke pot. And they would say, they'd see each other in the hallways and go like 4:20, you know, that type of thing. So nevertheless, now 40 years later, 50 years later, you get 30% off of Sunset Lake CBD's entire line of CBD products. They have 30% off of tinctures, which I use to help myself sleep. Gummies, hemp flower. Matt likes to use those smalls. The chocolate fudge, CBD infused chocolate fudge, and all the other CBD products. Use a code 420 for 30% off. The sale ends on April 23rd, so don't miss out. Don't forget, they also have a new product, CBD Dog Biscuits. They blended our CBD oil with three simple ingredients, peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour, to create delicious biscuits designed to comfort your four-legged friend. The treats each have 5 milligrams of CBD and contain no artificial flavorings or sweeteners. Am I the only one who sort of thinks that, like, I would eat those?
I was thinking I want some for my cats, but I chilled them.
That doesn't sound good to you? Like peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour?
The peanut butter sounds good.
Pumpkin sounds good. Oat flour sounds good to me.
I've never heard of oat flour.
I had a sense of, like, already what that tastes like. But this is for your dogs. It's got 5 milligrams CBD. So check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Great company, and they are giving you 30% off for the next week with the code 420. Good time to stock up on some of those tinctures for me, actually. And the pre-rolls. So check it out. Also, I've told this story many times before, and some time ago, my sisters and I wanted to provide meals for my mom. Because cooking is less of an option for her these days, and we wanted to make sure she was eating well. And so what we did is we did some investigating, and we finally decided on Freshly at freshly.com as the service that we wanted to send her meals. They offer delicious meals. They go directly to your door. There's no cooking required. You just got to heat them up. Takes just about 3 minutes to heat these things up in a microwave. And, but we knew that my mom would not let us pay for it. So my sisters told her that Freshly was advertising with the show, and they had given, you know, me like a lifetime free meals. And, so she has been eating Freshly for, probably a year and a half or so. And whenever I would talk to her on the phone, like, oh my God, the food was great. My favorite is the steak peppercorn. And I've told all my friends about it. And you're so lucky to have them advertising on the show. And of course they weren't. And then about, I don't know, 6 months ago, we got approached, and just coincidentally, they wanted to advertise on the show. And I couldn't have been happier. I still did not get a lifetime free Freshly, but nevertheless, my mom's happy. Now I'm happy too. You can visit freshly.com. Ordering is super easy. They have 30 meals, like my mom's favorite steak peppercorn. They also have stuff like chicken pesto bowl, Sasha's baked penne. There's like 30 different, maybe there's more now. $6.16 per meal for our listeners to try out Freshly. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/majority. You don't have to stress about dinner anymore. Go to freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Okay. Welcome to the show. The proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo and the columnist at salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Heather, you there? There she is.
Hello.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Emma is out for the day, so it's just the two of us. You know, we had planned to talk predominantly about Afghanistan and the announcement this week. And I want to get to that. I want to spend some time out. You wrote a great piece of it, but we have to start with just sort of the sort of tragedy on top of tragedy on top of horror this week.
Yeah.
And you know, we've had a rash of mass killings, which is, you know, one issue that is in sort of parallel in the context of our society. 8 people, including a killer in at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis last night. And then, of course, the video that came out, Vadim Toledo. And earlier in the week, Dante Wright killed by a police officer while the murder trial, Derek Chauvin, for the killing of George Floyd is taking place. The defense rests. I think they have only their closing statements in the beginning of next week. And so, I mean, there just seems to be this sort of like, I don't know, numbness or just sort of a passive quality. And then you mix that in with like the idea of like 700 people dying a day, you know, still from COVID, maybe more actually, 900. You really start to wonder, like, you know, what's the timing on wrapping up this whole society thing?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, it is numb, where it's as if we treat these things as an ongoing rolling set of natural disasters rather than things that are actually within our grasp to deal with. I mean, the COVID crisis, of course, is a natural disaster, but we had, you know, we developed methods of dealing with it, which for some reason we just can't seem to really wrap our minds around among a lot of Americans. They just don't want to accept that you have to do certain things, even though we've got this cure or this prevention that's you know, unfolding rapidly with the vaccines. They still can't wrap their minds around the fact that we still have to kind of, you know, be careful for a while. So we've got surges happening all over the country. And that's one thing. But gun violence, this is an ongoing disaster that we could fix with policing and with the mass shootings that we have. I mean, these are not things that we can't deal with. No other country in the world has anything like this. We are by far, you know, we have the highest rates of incarceration. We have the highest rates of gun violence. We have the highest rates of police killing of any, you know, developed country in the world. And it's unbelievable to me that we still, you know, a lot of people on Twitter today are putting out, you know, gee, in Texas, for instance, you know, there was one case of potential voter fraud and they raced to go and stop, you know, any possibility that anybody could ever commit voter fraud in the future and it designed to suppress the vote. But, you know, gun violence, it's just we shrug our shoulders. With policing, I was listening to what you said earlier about the idea of traffic stops. And, you know, I think that we're starting to see this may be a little bit of good news on that front, which is that I think we're starting to see some creative thinking in terms of how to deal with policing. And one of the things is that they're doing some experiments with not having police do traffic control. That's just not going to be their job. It'll be somebody else. And so when there's a traffic stop, there's no chance you're going to get arrested, right? It's not, nobody's going to, you know, take you in. For 99% of the time, people will pull over if the traffic cop or traffic, you know, I don't know what they'll call them, you know, the traffic controller stops you and gives you a ticket, or they just record your license plate, send you the ticket. You can, you know, protest it in some other way, you know, online or something like that, whatever the plan is. You know, that would take, you know, a bunch of these confrontations out of circulation. You just wouldn't have that if you don't have armed, you know, stormtroopers coming up to the car and suddenly seeing that, oh my God, there's a danger here, and using this pretextual thing where they take it, you know, they just use the traffic stop as an excuse to stop somebody and rouse them, which is essentially what these traffic stops for driving while black are. There's just, oh, we see a black guy in a car and I didn't like the cut of his jib, so I pulled him over for a, you know, an expired tag or whatever it was. So that's one thing. And then there's the idea that you, instead of having police respond to, you know, issues with mental health, where someone's having an episode of some sort, and you send out mental health workers instead, and they're doing that in Denver, and it's working great. I mean, really great, because cops are not prepared to deal with that, and they're not good at dealing with it, really. I mean, that just isn't something they know how to do, and I don't really think they have the temperament for it. That's just not the kind of thing that
I think that's. I mean, I think we could probably argue about which one of those three elements, right? They're not geared towards, they're not trained for it, or they don't have a temperament, you know, the type of person who, broadly speaking, not all cops probably, you know, you're attracted to certain professions because you have a certain personality type, and then you mix that in with a certain percentage of these people who have deeply held racist beliefs, or they, you know, whatever, they come from outside in the suburbs and they don't like, they have a mentality like they're going to war. And when you have a mentality going to war, you know, your fingers on that trigger, and, or you demand compliance, or, you know, whatever it feels like, you know, the idea of training racism out of cops is not going to happen, or it's just not a good strategy. Like, you need to basically prevent them from doing, from certain contacts they have with people, and can, I think, like, you know, continue to narrow the contexts in which they are deployed.
Absolutely. And I think I'm you know, we're seeing some of it's the most creative thinking that we've seen. I mean, the big idea over the last 20 or 30 years was this broken windows idea, which meant you had to go in and roust everybody because there would be a feeling of security in the community, and people would be less likely to create trouble if they saw that there was, you know, there was order. And, you know, that sort of contributed to this. Also, the fact, and we can, when we talk about Afghanistan, well, we can see the other side of this, is that we militarized the police tremendously in the last 20 years. Not only have we not, you know, given them the sort of, you know, the this community policing idea, not only have we sort of abandoned that, we went the opposite direction and started giving all kinds of surplus military equipment and everything to police. And part of this too is just this attitude, and I talked about this a bit in my piece this morning, because I was talking about tasers, which I've written a lot about over the years. And in so for Salon, I talked about this because the issue of the police officer, Kim Potter, up in Minnesota, thinking that she was grabbing her taser and she allegedly accidentally grabbed her gun. It's not the first time that's happened. It's happened, you know, they figure, you know, at least 20 times where a cop says that the reason they shot someone is because they thought they'd grabbed their taser. There's been a lot of research on this. And one of the things I found out that was interesting that I didn't know before is that they actually designed the taser to be like a gun because that's what police wanted. Now, that's ridiculous, because you wouldn't have to have a taser that looks like a gun. There are a million ways you could deploy a device like that. You could, somebody said, like a flashlight that had a, you know, you used your thumb instead of the like a trigger finger, something, so that there's just no concept of mistaking it. But the cops like it because of course it's an intimidation factor partially, right? You point that thing at somebody, it's a scary thing to have anything that looks like a gun, you know, pointed at you. And this is the point I'm getting at, is that a lot of this is just about, you know, coercive compliance, no questions asked. A cop pulls you over, you don't have a right to say anything, do anything, or make a mistake, because they are loaded for bear from the minute that you have any contact with them. I mean, and I can't even imagine what it's like to be a young black guy. I mean, my God, it must be terrifying to be in the presence, you know, to be in the presence of a cop who's sitting there, hey, dude, tell me what's going on here. And I mean, even I am terrified in front of a cop, and I, you know, I'm the last person on earth that should be, but you know, I don't know. I've had some real attitude from police at different times. It's not like they're all nice to, they have nice to anybody. And it's because of this attitude of, you know, this dominance thing, where they are trained in a sort of a military fashion to come in and dominate every session. And they're standing there armed like RoboCops with a taser on one hip and a gun on the other. And they're looking at people. And, you know, if you're a young Black guy and they're already in that mode, you know, just like the lieutenant that was pulled over the other day in Virginia, or I guess it was a couple months ago, but the video just came out where he put his hands out the window and he's going, I am afraid to get out of the car. You know, listen to me. I mean, he was very coherent, very, you know, logical in what he was saying. He said, look, I'm afraid to get out of the car. I totally could understand that. I could see it in
absolutely.
His face, the way they were talking to him, that dominance thing, you're going to ride the lightning, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, this is an attitude among American police that, you know, has got to change. And I don't, you're right. You can't take the racism out, but you can certainly change the idea that it's okay to talk to people that way.
I'm not even convinced that you can do that. I mean, I you know, like, I think you can try, but I just think that the answer is to continually whittle down their mandate. Their portfolio. They have a much narrower situation. There is no reason to be going like that video of, like you said, of the guy in the National Guard. There's no reason to be coming up to that car with your guns out. There's absolutely no reason for you even to be going to that car. And they shouldn't do it. You see it's these fishing expeditions.
Right.
And they go in and they're like, but these fishing expeditions are dangerous. Well, then don't go on them, mm-hmm. because there's no evidence that it's actually doing any benefit to society. And so much of it is generating, money for small towns or for, you know, jurisdictions. And there is a feedback loop within these organizations that as they get more, they get bigger, and as they get bigger, they want more, and you need to shrink them. To shrink them. And if you have other issues within a society, then you use the money that you get from shrinking those budgets and those entities, and you pour it into those other things to deal with those same issues. So, you know, if cops are going out to deal with homeless people, cut the mandate of the cops, save the money. And, you know, in Austin, they're doing that now, actually. Mm-hmm. They buy a hotel and they house people. I mean, mm-hmm. there's because the way that we're doing it is just it's not working. And it is maintaining this inequity in society that is, I agree with you. I told this story many times about, and I won't go into it again, but just, you know, when I was out as an actor in LA, I met a guy, long story short, who was just, he had a Range Rover, and he had been pulled over in the past, like, 4 weeks, like a half a dozen times. And he had called the police department and said, hey, I own this car. I keep getting pulled over. Is there some type of sticker I can get that will signify? And the guy he spoke to said, are you Black? And he's like, yes. And he goes, yeah, I'm sorry. There's really nothing I can do about it.
That's outrageous.
And it's, you know, I don't know how people, really make it through their lives like that. I really don't. Like, I mean, that notion of, I think for, you know, Chris Hayes, in his book, Colony in a Nation, I think it is. He talked about, there's basically two different experiences of policing in this country. And one is where, you know, the police are who you run to when you're in trouble. And the other is the police are who you run from because they're the trouble. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, largely on racial lines. I think it's also on class lines. You know, people living in poverty are over policed as well. But I think, you know, it is the, you know, to be a person of color in this country and deal with the police is just a fundamentally different experience.
And also, I just want to add one point to this is that, you know, first of all, well, 2 points, I guess. One is the tasers. Tasers are excessive force 99% of the time. I mean, I've been writing about this subject for years. The use of tasers is a compliance electroshock torture device, which is designed to make people comply with the police. And 99% of the time, it is excessive force. They did not need to deploy it. And they deploy it an awful lot of the time on mentally ill people. And people die from tasers. There's been hundreds of cases of people dying from them. They're used willy-nilly. And that should stop, too. You know, you hate to sort of bring that up in the middle of an epidemic of police shootings, because you figure, well, tasers are better than that. At least you can live through it. And I realize that. But it's really no different than if cops were beating people over the head with batons, because it is excessive force. It is a torture device. And there has to be a reevaluation of how those. I'm not saying they shouldn't carry them, but there should be, like the woman I think up in Minnesota, the police officer up there, she had no reason to use her taser on Dante Wright, much less shoot him with her gun. There was no reason to taser him. It was a traffic stop. She could have let him go. But that instant sort of agitation and reaction, I have to subdue this subject right now. And the second thing is that, you know, there's also guns in this country. The fact that there are so many guns, and I'm not defending the police here, but I will say that there are a lot of people with guns in this country. And if we could deal with that gun problem, which God knows, it just seems so intractable. I don't even, you know, I feel like we're just, you know, speaking into the void here. But if we had fewer guns in our country, there would probably be fewer shootings from anybody, including the police. And, you know, this is just one of those things that, you know, we can't confront because we have a whole bunch of people who are just determined that they need to have their toys, and there's no way that we're going to be allowed to control that. And it's outrageous. And it's different for us than it is with anyone else, any other developed country. And I just don't know what will change it. I mean, you know, shooting people, mass shootings of tiny children doesn't change it. Mass shootings of country music stars, you know, hundreds of people shot, doesn't do anything. So I don't know what it will take. And it's intensely frustrating that we just look at this stuff and go, well, gee, I really hope it works out, because that seems to be where we're at. And it's just awful.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, let's turn to Afghanistan, because you and I have been, you know, talking in this context for 18 years, maybe. I think to a large extent, you were a blogger in the early aughts, largely a function, I think for a lot of the bloggers anyways, was, you know, a reaction to the Bush election, but also more so, I think, like in many respects, the war. Yeah. The war, and I think, you know, for a lot of people, it was more about Iraq, but it was about our entire reaction to 9/11. And, you know, I think there was not, you know, going to Afghanistan was not as an invading Afghanistan was not as controversial as Iraq was, you know, at that time. But I think it quickly became just as controversial in many respects, and certainly through the years with the drone wars, and we've been there now for almost 20 years. Joe Biden announced earlier this week that we're leaving by 9/11 unconditionally. It is not a facts on the ground. It's not an assessment. There is no context in which we would stay past that date. There is no solution. It is a I don't think it's quite a slam dunk, but it's definitely the thing that we should do. But I think people should understand that on a large part, like, you know, we went in there, we broke it. And the point is we can't fix it, but it's still broken. And it's going to, and that breakage is going to cost people in Afghanistan. And there's, if there, you know, we need to mitigate it, but we broke it and it's broken. Right. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's just broken.
Absolutely. And the 20 years that we've been there has, you know, made the, you know, it has made, you know, very little difference. It's not to say it hasn't made none and it had made any, because there is some belief that the country has, you know, changed in some fundamental ways that may make it possible to mitigate some of the, what we're seeing as maybe the worst case scenario with the Taliban taking over and going back to the way it was in the late 90s. Which, you know, I mean, let's face it, that was partially our doing as well. I mean, we armed the Mujahideen, you know, we don't need to go into the whole history there, but you know, that whole thing, you know,
we should to a certain extent. I mean, we armed the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. We encouraged and funded the madrasas in Pakistan as a way of, you know, in Osama bin Laden as a way of fighting the Soviets. So, you know, we created this monster, right, that we are now going to leave the country to.
Right. We've been involved there for a very long time, longer than just the invasion of Afghanistan in, you know, after 9/11. I mean, we were there long before in involving ourselves in that. And, you know, think about that for a minute. I mean, you had the Soviet invasion there, you know, and which was a disaster for them as well. And we decided to use that as one of our many proxy wars against the, you know, communism. And, you know, that blew up in our face, just like Vietnam blew up in our face. I mean, this keeps happening. These proxy wars, these small wars that we continue. I mean, I guess it's better than having a world war or a nuclear war, but nonetheless, it's still war and it ends up being disastrous for everybody involved. And this one, you know, I mean, it was such a knee-jerk reaction. I remember thinking it at the time, and you were barely allowed to even think these things, if you recall, yep, the hysteria after 9/11. But I remember thinking when George Bush went to the World Trade Center and stood on the rubble with the firemen and everybody was crying, and, you know, and he gave his bullhorn moment, which was considered to be the greatest thing since Winston Churchill, you know, or FDR saying we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And he said, you know, we're coming to get them real soon. I hear you, and we're going to get them real soon, or whatever he said. And all of that just seems so primitive to me. I remember hearing it and just kind of going, really? I mean, is this, I get it. I mean, I understand the impulse. I'm not immune. 9/11 was a, you know, a nightmare. It was one of the most traumatic things that's ever happened to this country. I get it. But the idea that our government would respond in such a, you know, with such primitive, right, passion to a situation they understood from, well, maybe they didn't understand, but many people understood, was extremely complicated. And it was not going to get any less complicated. And God knows it didn't, because they immediately pivoted to Iraq. And then we really made a mess of things. But even Afghanistan itself, even that particular way that we had of dealing with it, there was a cathartic aspect to it. You know, it's like when a bear comes into town and mauls somebody, they immediately rush out with their guns and they kill a bear. It doesn't even matter which one it is, just as long as you kill something to sort of, you know, get your revenge on whatever it is. That was kind of the feeling. It was so primitive. And I thought, God, you know, we're a military superpower, the most powerful military on earth in human history. And this is how we react. I mean, we don't have any more sophistication than that. There's no way that we can kind of go forward here more thoughtfully. And it wasn't just the neocons and the Republicans, at least at that juncture. You know, we had the whole Congress out singing God Bless, yep, America on the steps of the Capitol. I mean, this was an American response. And, you know, like I said, I don't want to say that I don't understand the feeling, but on an intellectual basis, I was always, and it was one of the reasons why I started writing in that format that I was writing, was just, you know, really, this is the best we can do. I mean, here it is. It's, you know, we're in the you know, 21st century, and we can't respond with any more, sophistication than this. And so that was the beginning. And it was like everybody knew that it was going to be different. It was going to be impossible to get out. Everybody knew that what they were getting in. Remember, there was all this talk. I mean, it was called, what did they call it? The graveyard of empires, right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, history has said from the beginning. So was it hubris? I mean, no country on earth is less entitled to hubris in this particular regard than the United States of America, because Vietnam had just ended,
right?
You know, but 25 years before. So there was, or, you know, yeah, 25 years before. So there was no reason for us to think that we were somehow going to go in there. And, but that was, of course, you know, that's another story. That's the neocon, you know, starry-eyed neocons bringing democracy to the rest of the world. And, you know, the whole thing is just, is maddening. And here we are, and yeah, it's broken. And we broke it, you know, a lot of people helped, but we broke it. And now we're going to have to live with that failure on both a moral and a political basis. And, you know, I frankly admire Biden for having the guts to do that as a Democrat, because I think that people were hoping it would be a Republican who would get out of this thing. You know, Richard Nixon was the one who pulled the plug on Vietnam finally. And I think that that was a relief to a lot of Democrats, because the Democrats had to, bear the burden of the defeat in right. Vietnam. And Joe Biden will probably have to bear that burden as well, in the minds of many people in the United States.
And I don't think he's going to pay that big of a price of it. I mean, we didn't, you know, somehow there was no, you know, there was talk of Obama, you know, when he pulled out, and it leading to ISIS and whatnot. And, you know, we still have a massive presence in Iraq in the form of a, you know, an embassy, if you can call it that. I mean, it's really sort of just like a massive compound. But the responsibility that we have to Afghanistan, when we went in there, I'm sure you remember, you know, part of the sales pitch was like, you know, we're not going to leave it in ruins. We're going in there and we're going to do, like, in fact, Bush had to sort of took some heat from, like, supposedly nation building, because mm-hmm. he had said during the campaign that he wasn't going to do any nation building. And in fact, we were supposedly going in there to nation build. And the Taliban were horrible to women at that time. And there's every reason to believe that they're going to be horrible to women again. Women have made some advances in Afghanistan, from my understanding, but not necessarily huge, broad, widespread, because you still have, like, you know, the government can do one thing, but culturally there's still problems there. But it's just announced today that the Biden administration, according to the New York Times, is going to keep the target of refugee admissions this year at the historically low level set by the Trump administration, walking back an earlier pledge to welcome more than 60,000 refugees in the United States, supposedly because of the optics of what's going on with the immigration at the border, which is absurd and obscene. And we owe Afghanistan so much. The bare minimum is to open our doors to Afghanis who believe that when the Taliban comes in, they are going to be killed because of their involvement with the U.S. presence over 20 years, or that that they just want a better life because of what the Taliban is certainly going to end up. May not happen immediately, but over time, that's what's going to happen in that country. And the idea that we wouldn't fulfill that obligation, right? Like, these people need to come and come now. And the idea that we wouldn't fulfill that obligation after what we've done in that country is just obscene. It's just obscene. And the political reasons are absurd. You know, the idea, like, there's going to be a big outcry of, like, Afghani civilians coming into this country. I mean, give me a break.
Even if there is, you know, who cares? I mean, right. You know, that's right. That's irrelevant. And, you know, it's interesting because I didn't realize that Joe Biden, and apparently in his first year as a senator, and it's really, you know, he's been around a long time, was during the debate over the Vietnamese refugees that were, you know, had helped the United States through that long ordeal and were in danger in Vietnam. And apparently Biden was against it then and against bringing those Vietnamese back. Now, it seems completely absurd, bizarre to me that, you know, Mr. Compassion, you know, whose entire, you know, presidential brand is his great, you know, loving
humanity, right?
Would not have changed in that regard. He was a much, you know, more, you know, flinty character when he was young. I mean, he was not like, he didn't have this great, you know, sort of aura of superhumanity that he has now. So I'm not surprised that he did that then, being the person that he was then, but he's a lot's changed. So this really surprised me to hear this. And I'm hoping they change their mind. Well, they have to. The immorality of what happened with Afghanistan is overwhelming, regardless of what we do. Just the fact that you know, we helped set up a situation that caused a great trauma in our own country, and then went and created a great trauma in their country. And, you know, I shouldn't say we created it. Their country was already in trauma, but we exacerbated it. And were unable to achieve the things that, you know, most people knew they couldn't achieve. That was the big neocon dream. Remember, I mean, that was their whole thing, was they were going to turn the Middle East into the, you know, flowering of democracy. Every country, they were going to make it all into, you know, Jeffersonian democracies. It was absurd. We all were watching this going, are you kidding? You know, I mean, nothing has ever seemed as naive as what they had in their mind, to use military force to create something like that. And, you know, at the point of a gun, but they apparently thought they could do it. And that experiment, you know, went horribly awry. And the immorality of that we're going to have to live with. And the lesson of that, again, in my lifetime, twice now, we've had to withdraw from wars that left, you know, terrible carnage behind us and left the people there to their own devices. And in Vietnam, I mean, they have recovered now. It's been a long time, of course, and there was tremendous suffering, but they did manage to do that. My hopes are that Afghanistan will be able to do that too. I mean, nothing would make me happier than to see the country pull itself together and be able to create something of a, you know, a self-governance that doesn't include a repressive, authoritarian, fundamentalist religious sect that wants to, you know, basically, you know, oppress women and anyone who's, you know, who's not a, you know, patriarchal male. But whatever happens, I mean, the idea that we would not help these people who helped the U.S. through 20 years of that occupation is just, it's unacceptable. I mean, it is absolute. I mean, even, you know, I mean, Gerald Ford, you know, opened the doors for the Vietnamese refugees to come here. And you remember the horror of all of that, yeah, too. I mean, the boat people and everything, yep, people escaping. And you know, this is another one of those situations, and we have to do it. I mean, we have to do it. And if Joe Biden can't do that, well, then, you know, none of this really makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, if everything about it, yes, you know, we need to get out, it's expensive, and we shouldn't have our troops in danger, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we have to get out because it's the wrong thing to do. And part of the only way we can right any of that is to bring those people here or somewhere. I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, they've got to go somewhere.
Well, and let's be clear, like the argument that it's better for Afghanistan at this point, for us to leave, is there's an argument that it's not. You know, I mean, there's, you know, the Afghani, I mean, there's a reason why Blinken's over there, and he isn't, you know, saying, like, you know, we're not going to totally abandon you. We're going to have drones, and we're going to have special ops or something like that, which.
Oh, there will be CIA there for sure.
Of course, we have everywhere. Yeah. And it is because it is bad for us to be there, that we have an ongoing war that is, you know, the longest war that we've ever been involved in. I would say, you know, we would have put more troops in there, but, you know, look, we've killed In Afghanistan, the civilian numbers are sort of hard to figure out because we underreport how many we killed. But I think like the official number is probably like 40, 50,000 civilians have been killed as a direct function of us. Maybe 30,000 as a direct function of us. But, you know, there's an underreporting that we always get with the drone warfare in particular. But what we need to, I mean, this is, you know, we need this country to go through a period of reparations. And I'm looking at this hemisphere and the other, and frankly, within our country. Heather, that's all the time that we have this week. We'll see you again in the future. Thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. All right, folks, just wrapping up here. That is quite a week. We will be back Monday with this program. Emma will rejoin us. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. And, you know, we did have a bill, reparations, that got out of committee this week. I don't know that it's going to make it to the floor, but at one point, you know, we break things and there are things that we cannot fix, but we can maybe with some funding, maybe mitigate some of the harm. So hope springs eternal, and we will see you on Monday. And for those of you sticking around, boy, oh boy, do we have a treat. I'll take the break later. Let's bring him on. I understand he's a little bit. Okay, there's David Feldman. There's a picture of David Feldman. Do we have him on?
Hello?
Oh, there he is.
Am I going to do this?
They won't see the image.
They won't see that image. Okay. David, welcome to the show.
So I'm going to do the show?
Yeah, we're on now. I understand. Okay. I don't want to express this, but I just saw from Brendan that you have some hesitation, and I was not aware of that. To come on today,
I you know, you've put me in an uncomfortable position.
I didn't. Brendan sent me the message just a moment ago, and I'm sorry. Is there a problem?
No. I think you've just you've put me in a awkward position that I have to come on after that discussion about Afghanistan, and I don't know. I'd
it's
rather reschedule.
Disturbing. I mean, we can reschedule. I know this is disturbing, but I mean, we've talked about, you know, difficult stuff on the show all the time. That's sort of part of the.
Well, yeah, but you know, you're the show. Like I have to. You're putting me in an uncomfortable position because I have to respond to some of the things you've said, and I don't want people to misapprehend what I think.
Respond to some of the things I've said in the conversation with Heather
about Afghanistan, the things you've been saying about Biden's decision to surrender in Afghanistan. And I
didn't say that,
you know, I don't want to be the guy. I don't want to be that guy, but I don't want to be the guy who says we shouldn't be surrendering to the Afghanistan.
I didn't say that we were surrendering. I didn't say that.
Okay.
Are you
right? And Rudy Giuliani, right. Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump didn't say storm the Capitol on January 6th. I mean,
wait a second.
You know how to say things, Sam, and not say them at the same time. You know exactly what you're doing. And that's why told Brendan, I'm not really comfortable talking to you about surrendering in Afghanistan.
Okay, wait a second. So are you suggesting that you are characterizing what Joe Biden is doing as surrendering?
You're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm asking.
No, you're putting words in my mouth. I'm not that guy.
Well,
I'm a pacifist. I'm a pacifist. So I don't want to be put in a position where I have to say that people like you are doing a disservice to, you're stabbing America in the back in Afghanistan. I don't want to be that guy. That's not who I am. I'm a pacifist. I'm against war in all its forms. And to have me have to come on now and say we shouldn't surrender in Afghanistan, I don't want to be that guy. I'm a pacifist.
Well, but you're being that guy. I mean,
No, I'm not. We've talked about, America should, I'm against war. I hate aggression. I hate conflict. I'm a man of peace. And quite frankly, if you don't think I'm a pacifist, I will smash your face in. Seriously, that's how opposed to war I am. And I'm the least violent person you know.
Well, I'm not contending that you're not violent. You seem to be saying that this is a surrender by Biden. If you want to call it a surrender, that's fine. But do you think we should leave, or do you think we should stay?
See, this is I don't want to have to answer that question. I'm just saying this is why I told Brendan I don't want to follow this conversation, because I'm saddened by this, and I don't
think about it,
because I'm a pacifist. Okay.
Right. Okay. And so we're getting out of the country. We're not going to be waging the kind of war that we've been waging.
I think it's a little early to end our endless war in Afghanistan.
It's been 20 years, David.
Not even 20 years. It's just a kid. It's just a kid. The war is just a kid.
So you're saying that a 19-year-old war is too young?
It's too young to just end it. And I don't want to be this guy, Sam, who has to talk this way because I'm a pacifist. But you just don't pack up and leave an endless war, especially when we're so close to winning this thing.
Wait a second. I mean, you're suggesting that we're close to winning in Afghanistan?
You're dishonoring the weapons with that sarcasm, quite frankly. And I don't want to be the guy who's saying we should stay. I'm not that guy, but you got to give the Pentagon another 15 years. We've only been there
30,
not even 20.
Years. So you're
not
saying,
even 20.
You're saying that
not even,
the war should last 35 years. Why 35?
Because we are so close to achieving serious headway. We are like years away in Afghanistan from achieving and making serious headway, and you're stabbing America in the back by saying end it.
What is serious headway? What does that mean? Serious headway.
Serious headway. I would say 15 years away from serious headway. And then we all know what comes after that, a potential beachhead. I mean, I don't want to be this guy, Sam. I don't want to be the guy who's saying stay in Afghanistan. I'm from the 60s. I'm a peace guy, but you can't leave when we're only a few decades away from a potential beachhead in Afghanistan. It's a disservice to our weapons.
Wait, a disservice to our weapons? What does that mean? A beachhead? A beachhead for what?
So how a disservice to you don't care about our weapons?
I don't.
You're saying that? Oh, wow, man, you are. Ice water through your veins, man. Really? You would say this in public, that you don't care about our weapons? Really? Wow.
No, wait.
Wow, you just revealed so much. I'm having I'm having a little Irish coffee.
Wait, now let me ask you a question. We stay there for 15 more years out of respect for our weapons.
Yeah.
And we get a beachhead. And then what do we do with the beachhead?
We reassess. Blue Ribbon Commission.
So we have,
you're impatient. Look, you think you've cornered the market in feeling bad about the war in Afghanistan? You think you're the only one who misses our weapons? You think it doesn't pain me every day sending our warheads and our firearms off to foreign lands with no guarantee that we'll ever see them again? You think you're the only one who feels bad for our weapons?
I don't feel bad for our weapons.
You do. You're just saying that to be a you know, the devil's advocate. Of course you feel bad for the weapons.
What weapons in particular do you feel bad for?
I feel bad for the weapons that keep us safe, that put it on the line every day. And they're brave.
And what about the military personnel that we have there?
You know, you don't get it. You don't get it.
What about you, civilians?
Hey, don't go there. I've known you. You knew me. Come on. You know my mother's brother, Paul. Come on.
You're
going to go there on that,
your
Sam?
Uncle Paul.
My uncle Paul. The military, you're going to bring up the troops? You're going to bring up the troops? I witnessed firsthand what war can do to a man. My mother's brother, Paul, came home from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they spat on him.
They did not spit on
him. They spat on him.
There was no spitting.
There was. Yeah, because that's what you want to believe. And they called him a baby killer. All because when he was in Vietnam, he killed babies, a lot of them. And I had to see my Uncle Paul come home from Vietnam and get called a baby killer because he killed a lot of babies. So don't tell me that I don't care about war and the troops. I've seen the damage that it does, okay? It's the whiny liberals. And I think you're a leftist, quite frankly. You lost the war for us on the home front in Vietnam. You made us fight that war.
I was.
With our arms tied around our back. We could have won in Vietnam, but it was demonstrators who lost the war.
7 or 8, I think, when the whole
Your mother was bringing you to those anti-war rallies and undermining the war effort.
Right. And do you see that happening here?
I mean, yes, you're stabbing America in the back, and you're dishonoring the memory of the hundreds of thousands of weapons we've left on the battlefield. Did they explode in vain? Is that what you're saying? How do we explain to the manufacturers of all those warheads that they were exploded for no reason? Is that you want to look at the people who own stock in Raytheon and General Dynamics? You want to look them straight in the face and say all those bombs that you dropped on Afghanistan were for naught? All those bombs, all your bombs are never coming home for nothing? Is that what you want to say? Are you willing to go on record and say that, Sam? I don't think you are.
Well, I mean, I am, but that's not the point. I mean,
you know, you think you're being funny. Oh, I am. You think you're being funny. Jesus, we're talking about endless war, Sam. We have an endless war in Afghanistan, and you're trivializing it.
I don't think that we're pulling out because of mass protest. Have you seen mass protest?
It's the mass protest. It's the way you treat the people who work at Raytheon and Dow Chemical and General Dynamics. You make them feel bad about what they do. And it undermines the war effort. And it's why we lost in Vietnam.
Because people made the folks at like General Electric feel bad because of all the weapons they were building.
Yeah. Yeah. You're stabbing us in the back because you're impatient. You're impatient. You're a child. I shouldn't be. This is why I told Brendan I don't want to come on today, because I had to follow that conversation. You're an impatient child. You want instant gratification. And I can't believe that it's not even 20 years in Afghanistan and you want to bring the weapons home. I can't believe it.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, David. First off, I mean, 20 years is a long time for a war. It's the longest war that we've ever participated.
No. Your generation wants instant gratification. That's the problem.
My generation is has basically. Well, all right.
You're impatient. You're impatient. Mommy, now. Mommy, give it to me now. I showed you the last time we had dinner. I showed you the
mid 50s.
Well, you know what? You should know better and you should act like you're in your mid 50s instead of the child that you are. Impatient, instant gratification. There's a timetable for bringing the weapons home.
What is the timetable?
You have to understand the timetable. The war, it's a war on terror. It's an endless war on terror, which puts America on, you know, a permanent war footing against Islamo-fascists. Mm-hmm. And you have to think of Islamo-fascists like you would the Nazis, you know, or Dax Shepard. You know, you have to fight them every step of the way. They're
World
not just
War II was lasted, you know, by any measure, you know, less than 6 years.
Too soon. We didn't end the we didn't take on Stalin because of the protest movement back home. We lost World War II. We surrendered half of Europe to communism, to Joseph Stalin, because people like you, oh, it's too much fighting. Oh, let's end the war. We'll just cave to Joseph Stalin and give him all of Eastern Europe.
David.
We didn't win world. We lost World War II because of people like you who are children.
What? Tell me about your time in the military.
I would have served in Desert Storm in 1991, but I had a football injury. I destroyed my knees blowing a man for Super Bowl tickets.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but I would have served because I was for that war.
What do you feel about the idea that we're not taking in refugees?
Now is not the time to bring people into America. And I say this, you know, I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for Ellis Island. You know, America saved my entire family from the ravages of World War II. So it pains me to say this. I got mine. I don't care about anybody else. And it pains me to say that, but I'm an adult. America saved my family during World War II. If you're a refugee, go find another country to save you. You know, believe me, when I see the Statue of Liberty, my eyes well up.
We've done enough, is what you're saying.
I'm saying I got mine.
Fair.
I got what I needed from America. That doesn't mean everybody should be able to get what they want from America. And it pains me to say that, but I'm an adult.
Well,
I'm an adult.
You're an adult. All right. Let me ask you this, David. I want to just turn. Can we just agree to disagree on this?
No, you don't. You have you hate America and you rather see us surrender and lose face. I mean, what about pride? What about just the pride of losing a war? You have kids. You tell your kids, hey, don't worry. You lost the soccer game. It's okay. No, you don't lose. We don't lose wars because that's a matter of pride. It's a matter of pride. And you know what?
You want to keep that war going on until
for pride to save face.
Yeah.
And you don't end a permanent war. This is a permanent war on terror. You want a timetable? We leave Afghanistan when we have achieved a permanent war on terror. The war on terror is not permanent yet. When it's permanent, then we can leave Afghanistan and go fight terror somewhere else.
My understanding, David, I didn't want to get into any of this, frankly, and I don't think it's...
You're stabbing America. You know what? During Vietnam, it was in the back. You're stabbing America in the heart saying, in the heart.
David, my understanding is you got a new job recently. Is that true?
I'm running for Gutfeld.
Right.
Yeah. He's a good man. He's read a book. I think he's even read more than one book.
Are you enjoying it? Are you?
It's an open and safe environment, and it's a free and easy writing room. And there's kindness first. He always says, you know, it's not important to be funny. It's to be careful who we're targeting. What are we saying? Who are we targeting? He's a great, great, kind man.
Do you have
and he doesn't smell. He does not smell, despite what he looks like. He does not smell. He can't spell either.
Right.
Parts of his brain have been scooped out by a lobotomist.
I'm glad that's working out for you.
And we don't stab America in the back like they do over at the Majority Report.
Yeah.
Do you know the Powell Doctrine?
You break it, you own it.
No, that's, I believe that was Chris D'Elia's pickup line to a 17-year-old girl.
Okay.
Break it, I own it. I think, before he deflout.
Yeah, this is good. So you've been working at Gutfeld for a while then.
Yeah. And one of the things I learned is when you go to war, you have a clear and attainable objective.
Overwhelming. Okay, yes, right. I got you.
And an exit strategy.
And your exit strategy is no exit.
No. The fighting continues until we achieve a permanent state of war. That's the exit strategy.
That's not an exit strategy. What's the vibe in the room at Gutfeld?
We make fun of the displacement theory. And, the idiots who, think Dominion rigged the election in favor of Joe Biden. A lot of reading. We have a book club.
Yeah.
We're reading Ulysses, James Joyce. Greg is a big fan of Ulysses and very well read, very well educated. Gutfeld.
David, let me just thank you for coming on today. I would love to hear more in the future, but we sadly have run out of time.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I'm sorry that this sort of broke down into this.
I would have preferred to, not have to come on the show and be the guy, because that's not who I am. I'm not the guy who says, don't surrender to the Taliban. I'm not that guy. I have long hair. I use the F word a lot. Mm-hmm. I smoke dope.
Yeah.
I listen to rock and roll. So I'm not the guy who's for continuing the war in Afghanistan, but I don't want to be that guy. You put me in a corner. Yeah. Dave, I mean, I have faded jeans on right now. Dave. And I call people brother. Sometimes I'll say, hey, brother, man. So I'm not the guy who's going to be saying, let's stay in. I don't want to be that guy, but you've kind of forced me.
No, I'm sorry, brother, man.
Listen, what would you tell Joe Biden if you were in the White House, in the Oval Office with him, just you and him?
Privately?
Yeah.
It is an honor to be in this room. And I have not looked at the Daily Mail in the past month, Mr. President. I have not seen the pictures of Hunter with his meth teeth, because I think who cares if Hunter Biden has meth teeth and makes videos for Pornhub and and does crack cocaine with prostitutes. That's none of my business, Mr. President. You know why it's none of my business if Hunter Biden smokes crack with prostitutes and would be in jail if he were black and not the son of the president? You know why it doesn't matter to me? Because it's not Eric Trump or Don Jr. smoking crack with a, if they smoked crack with a prostitute, Mr. President, then that would be compromise. And we would have to, we should look into that because they could bribe Donald Trump. If people got their hands on photographs of Hunter Biden, Eric Biden, Donald Trump Jr. Biden with meth teeth and a prostitute and crack cocaine, that would be compromise if that were on Trump's son's laptop. And we would have to investigate that, but not if it's Hunter Biden. That's what I would say, Mr. President Joe Biden.
Well, David Feldman, you can check out the David Feldman Show. I'm sorry this didn't go as planned, David. And hopefully next time we come back on and we won't have this type of controversy.
Okay, I just want to remind everybody that I'm a pacifist. And if you say I'm a warmonger, I'll smash your fucking face in.
Okay. Sweet. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
David Feldman.
Peace. Down. Peace, brother man. Peace, brother man.
Peace out.
Okay. Man. Okay, brother man.
Bye. That was not what I anticipated today. I didn't realize that he was that. I assumed his position on Afghanistan was a little bit different. Did not anticipate that. So I... supposed to be, fun. Talk to him about his time on Gutfeld, and he comes in with that, and the whole thing, it gets it's not as interesting, not as interesting. It's not as fun. It's fun. So, folks, that is our first half of our show has now ended. I'm sorry, that threw me off a little bit. I just did not expect David Feldman to be so pro endless war. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. And you help keep the show going. You can also support this show by going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend. Check out the AM Quickie. Do that. And you can hear the headlines every morning. Today it was out like 5 o'clock in the morning, it seemed like 6 in the morning. Don't forget, check out Nomi Show, the Noma Key Show, youtube.com/the Noma Key Show. She has great interviews every day. Oh, it's Femme Friday. I don't know who's on today, but check it out. The Noma Key Show, youtube.com/the Noma Key Show, or twitch.tv/the_Noma Key_show. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media empire?
Yeah, last night, Jim and Laura of the Reclaim Idaho documentary about the Medicaid expansion success there were on. And also Cale Brooks, a Jacobin video editor, we talked about using online platforms for political education and propaganda, the opportunities and limitations of that, and for doing actual politics. So check that out last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
All right. Quick break. See you in the fun half. To love you, babe. Keep an eye on the road. To let you know.
want to